I'm the speaker that's not from Hawaii, unfortunately. I'm from North Carolina State University, where it's going on 11 p.m. right now, but that's okay. We all know what we're supposed to eat, right? We're supposed to have half of our plate as horticultural products, fruits and vegetables. 5 to 13 servings a day, which equates, if you're going to put it in consumer terms, 2.5 cups to 6.5 cups per day of fruits and vegetables combined. But, you know, despite the fact that there's been extensive educational campaigns, government-led campaigns, and a lot in the popular press over decades now, there's been very little that's moved the needle in the American public in particular eating an adequate amount of fruits and vegetables each day. A really huge gap between the recommended intake and the actual consumption patterns. Most U.S. consumers were talking about 5 servings a day, and almost only like 3% of American consumers, and Americans are the worst, only about 3% of American consumers are eating both fruits and vegetables each day. So it's pretty pathetic. But what about looking at not getting, since we can't seem to move the needle on how much people eat, how about looking at not having people eat more, which is really tough to get them to do, but try to get more from what we eat, get more available, bioavailable nutrients and phytoactive compounds from each serving of fruits and vegetables that we take in. And that's really what we're talking about here. Because we are really good as breeders, as horticulturists, at breeding into plants what we want. You might be looking at disease tolerance, or looking at salt tolerance, or cold tolerance, or content, maybe increased vitamin content in a fruit, or increased anthocyanins, which is the pigments in blueberries there. But we're not so good at looking at how, it really doesn't even matter so much, and this is what we're just learning, how much good stuff we've got in a particular piece of produce. What really matters is how well it gets into the human system, how well it's utilized by the human body, and there's a lot of variation there. If you think just about blueberries as an example, when you're taking in a blueberry or any fruit and vegetable, you'll take it in and you'll expect some absorption to come out of your stomach and your upper intestine. That's the classic absorption. And the phytoactive compounds and the minerals and the vitamins will then go into circulation and be distributed throughout the body and into the organs where they're accumulated, depending on what that active compound is, or could be something that has to go through the colon and be worked on and metabolized by our very extensive microbiota before they are released as metabolites into digested and released out into circulation through colonic and get into circulation there, which is a delayed bioavailability. So really how available these fruits and vegetables are is more important than how much we eat, because a lot of what we eat, a lot of the good stuff we eat, just goes right out and is excreted. I mean, people eating vitamin C tablets, you know, most of that's just going out in the urine. We're not even getting much out of it, because really what's important is what's bioavailable. So this is where a particular Hawaiian berry, ohelo, Vaccinium reticulatum, has been a beautiful model system for examining how bioavailable is a fruit or a vegetable in the human body. Again, it's not something that a breeder normally thinks about. It's not something you can check off on your phenotype checklist as you're going down a row of plants in the field, but really it's critically important how bioavailable the nutrients and the phytoactive compounds are. Now, Vaccinium reticulatum is a wild plant in Hawaii. It grows mostly on this island, and most of our collections were in Volcano National Park on this island. There's also some in Molokai and a little bit in Oahu and some in Kauai and I think one other island I can't quite remember. A little bit on Maui as well. But exclusive to the Hawaiian Islands and known for growing on weathered lava flows. And a really tough, tough berry this is, because it can grow on these devastated volcanic lava flows, and it can withstand a fall of volcanic ash up to 25 centimeters. So we're talking like 10 inches of ash on top of it, and it can still survive. It's a really tough little guy. So that's where it grows, on volcanic ash, in the weirdest places. Okay, it's just a very tough plant that is determined to survive under very low fertility, under conditions where nothing else can survive. It is tough. And honestly, I'll make a case here, because I work a lot on wild plants, wild endemic plants, and through global bioexplorations. And the best place to look for phytoactive compounds that are active in the human body is to look in the wild, because elicitation is really, really what makes a plant produce these bioactive compounds that end up being important for human health as well. Elicitation is usually environmental factors, environmental stresses that provoke a plant to accumulate secondary compounds rather than just grow and develop. So here we have a tiny little ohelo plant that's there's hardly anything to it at all, and yet it's putting out a berry full of phytoactive compounds. And it is a wild plant, so it doesn't look like a beautiful landscape plant that you're used to. Oh, it's a very close relative of blueberry and cranberry, and contains the same classes of active compounds as cranberry and blueberry, like proanthocyanidins, antimicrobial proanthocyanidins, the anthocyanin pigments. So it has activity in anti-cancer, cardiovascular, anti-diabetic activity, neuroprotective activity, all these same activities that we associate with cranberry and blueberry, and those phytoactive compounds are very much present and in high concentrations and a very diverse profile in the ohelo. So it's just growing all over the place. And if you do a little touring on the island post-conference, you'll find it everywhere in Volcano National Park on the lava flows. We even found this one on the top of a 7-foot mailbox pole, because the birds love the berries. So it gets around that way. And you'll find it all over, you know, in the harshest possible scenarios. So this is a graduate student, a former graduate student of mine, and my daughter, just harvesting some of these ohelo berries in Volcano National Park. The graduate student needed to collect these berries for his research, for his thesis, and my daughter just wanted to come to Hawaii, so they had at it. And they even found the ohelo growing around the perimeter of a lava tube, you know, where the lava had come down and solidified and formed the hollow tube where it had come down, and the little ohelo berries were all around. But the real reason that ohelo turned out to be a beautiful model for investigating bioavailability of phytoactives in the human body was not so much because it had a high content, yes, it does, but it also adapted beautifully to plant tissue culture. So we were able to take the berries and the seeds and the berries from the ohelo and shipped them out of Hilo, as I mentioned to you earlier, and got them back to the lab, and from them grew little microplants and callus cultures from those plants, and then adapted that to produce callus cultures. And the callus cultures, under the right stresses in vitro, were able to produce the whole range of flavonoids that you'd associate normally with the berry, with a cranberry, blueberry, and with the ohelo berry. all the anthocyanin pigments, all the smaller phenolic acids, the proanthocyanidins. You could get the whole range growing in the tissue culture. And the thing that was beautiful about tissue culture is then you could add to the tissue culture medium radio-labeled precursors that the tissue culture would use in metabolism, and then those metabolites, those bioactive metabolites, would have the radio label on them. So we could track in an animal model what was the distribution, what was the bioavailability of each of these bioactive compounds because of the radio label. We're able to do it with stable isotope as well, and we're able to use it in humans as well with stable isotope, but we're just talking about the radio label right here. So we had a very sustainable system of plant tissue cultures growing in the lab. And the advantages of using this tissue culture approach, cell culture approach, is it was very predictable, very reliable. The yields were uniform over a multiple cell subcultures. Very easy in this simple system to extract the bioactive compounds without degradation. It's harder to get them out of a berry or a complex tissue without degrading some compounds, but in a cell culture, very, very simple. You don't have a lot of interferences from the plant material that you normally have. A high, high percentage of flavonoid compounds. And the components were the whole gamut of compounds that are in the fruit. You found them in the plant cell culture. Very clean source of standards that weren't available commercially. And it was a beautiful model to test how elicitation, how stresses would provoke the deposition of these bioactive compounds, gave us that source of labeled compounds. Now, you can't grow these things in a tissue culture room like you would anybody who's doing in vitro culture because they're metabolizing cell cultures and they're going to be using the radio-labeled glucose or fructose or whatever we put in the cell culture, and they'll be respiring radio-labeled CO2 as well. So we had to have it in an enclosed chamber, and this was designed by Michael Grusek with USDA, who worked with us to develop this enclosed chamber system where we could grow the cultures and have a flow-through air system, kind of even flow-through air system where the carbon dioxide, the atmosphere would be contained and captured and wouldn't get out into the atmosphere. So this is just a diagram showing that radio-labeled system, which would then be put under lights for growing, and I'll show that in just a sec. So here's the whole system. I mean, we take those Ohelo plants, which were originally collected here and had some greenhouse specimens, which we could use as explants to produce microcultures, very sustainable, very uniform, keep it going. And from that callus, which was made more friable through a series of steps to produce a continuous suspension culture and then provoked through elicitation, some additions to the medium, to produce a very highly pigmented culture, which would produce all of those compounds that we needed and could very easily then isolate either as a crude extract or as isolated compounds to feed into animal models. So that's an example of the system in and how we would then, the two columns, are the ascorite columns on the side are collecting the radio-labeled CO2 and keeping it out of the atmosphere. So the yield out of this was beautiful. I mean, you could provoke the culture in different ways and provoke different levels and concentrations and intensities of flavonoid compounds, and you know, as you can really see through the anthocyanin pigment there, which is one of the main ones, one of the main bioactive ones. So gave us a really uniform system. So this next part is in collaboration with colleagues at Purdue University, because we're able to take those extracts, those very uniform, reproducible, radio-labeled extracts from cell culture, and gavage them into a rodent model, into a rat model in this case, and follow that bioavailability. How much of this bioactive compound, phytoactives, flavonoids, how much of it actually does get into circulation? How quickly is it excreted in a rodent model? And what each of these rats were fitted into a Kulex system where they had a jugular probe and an interstitial fluid probe. And you'd outfit the rats with these probes, and they would just be free living for weeks in the Kulex system with these probes. So after the gavage of radio-labeled compound, you could follow through the excretion and through blood draws on these rats where the compounds had gone. And this isn't one of the technicians just working with the rats in the Kulex system. So just for the metabolic tracking of these crude extracts, and I'll show you crude extracts now, and this is an example of the rat who didn't seem to mind these systems at all. I don't know why, but they were very happy and free living and acted normal. But we would automatically, the system, not the rats did not have to be handled, because rodents go through a lot of stress when they're handled for blood draws, but the system would automatically blood draw at all these different time points after gavage of the compound. Now, my PhD is in horticulture science and joint major in plant biology, so my colleagues at Purdue had to give me a crash course on how we were measuring the metabolites in the animal system and how you figure out what's going on. And what it is the metabolites get into the gut, they're gavaged into the gut, the stomach and the gut, and they'll get into the blood and the interstitial fluids between cells, and then they'll go to cells and tissues, but then they can also go back, they can also be circulated back to the interstitial fluids. And so what we found through looking at the counts of the radio-labeled compounds that were gavaged into the rodents is we found that there was two peaks in the counts over a period of time, which indicated, for example, that some of the compound was getting into the stomach and immediately being absorbed into the body, and some of it had to go down into the colon and be worked on by gut microbiota before it would get into circulation, which made a delay in the time, and you'd have two peaks. But most of it was requiring the gut microbiota in order to work, so it took a longer time. So a lot of cool outcomes came from looking at a radio-labeled extract into rats. Like, you could see that anthocyanins, that class of compounds, were better absorbed than proanthocyanidins. Proanthocyanidins are the compounds in cranberry that are antimicrobial, that are responsible for inhibition of urinary tract infection, for example. And anthocyanins, more well known for anti-diabetic effects, anti-cancer, cardiovascular. The interstitial fluid kinetics paralleled what we saw in the blood, but there was a lag time, so you'd see it a little bit later. And then, interestingly, the serum concentrations of some of these metabolites that would reach the target tissues they weren't indicative of what would reach the target tissue. So the interstitial fluid concentration didn't exactly correlate with the serum concentration. So there were some differences in bioavailability that were evident here that you wouldn't have known without the radio label. I think one of the most important things that we discovered here is that we were able to demonstrate conclusively here is that the metabolites from the ohelloberry, that whole group of flavonoid metabolites, did accumulate in brain tissue. This was a huge source of contention for a couple of decades, where there was a lot of anecdotal evidence and a lot of epidemiological evidence that showed that consumption of anthocyanins, as in berries, some of the traditional ecological knowledge, would be preventative against Alzheimer's disease, dementia, Parkinson's disease, a lot of ecological knowledge there. But the argument from the scientific community, especially physicians, was it can't possibly pass the blood-brain barrier. We showed through these tests that they did indeed pass the blood-brain barrier and can therefore be effective, or the metabolites pass the blood-brain barrier, the radio-labeled metabolites, and accumulated, and therefore would be available to work with the neurons in dementia and other neuroprotective effects. One of my colleagues related to this was feeding the wild berries to a group of humans in a clinical study at UNC Charlotte, and a long-term feeding study, and she worked with elderly patients, not with dementia, not with Alzheimer's, but just at the point where they're kind of forgetting things, maybe like we all are. And she was working with them over time, feeding them the equivalent of about a cup and a half of berries a day for up to 6 months. And she was looking at these elderly people, and she had like a kind of like a bathing cap that she'd put on their heads with neuroprobes that would be able to measure brain activity on these elderly patients, and she'd test them, and she'd have some computer tests where they'd have to do matching and memory type tests, and she would measure through there what was going on with these people and how berry consumption might change their, have neuroprotective effects, and how it might change their cognitive ability. One of her most exciting results from this test, this long-term test, was that she saw an improvement in the ability of the eye, a 60 millisecond improvement of cognitive performance on the eye, of the ability to register cognitively. 60 milliseconds. Sounds like nothing, right? But it takes 13 milliseconds for the human eye to look at an image, process it, bring it into memory. So 60 milliseconds, that's a huge improvement. And it was statistically significant and really a huge boon for her. That she saw some gender differences. The female participants even did a little bit better when they had placebo, probably because they liked the social interaction of the test. But the males, they didn't like the test at all, but they saw real improvement when they had berries. But more of this, the significance of the results was at 6 months, and then we'll come back to that in a minute. So radio labeling using the animal models, that was one way of looking at bioavailability of these compounds. But another model that we've used is a simulated gastrointestinal tract, which was TNO model, or called TIM-1. It's an upper gastrointestinal tract model. This was in collaboration with some colleagues at Rutgers University, where we have this model, and you can see how large it is compared to the technician standing next to it, that mimics the body temperature, the peristaltic movements through different components of the gastrointestinal tract, pH, enzymes, everything as much as possible. And this is a model that's used by drug companies routinely to see how well a drug clears through the human system or where it's absorbed in the human system. This particular model did not have a colon. It was just the upper gastrointestinal tract. And it was a unique opportunity to use it for plants, very seldom used for plants or plant extracts, and to look at the fate of these phytochemicals. It could predict bioavailability, we call it bioaccessibility in TIM, and stability and digestibility. And it limits the need for test animals. That's one reason the drug companies use it so much. But these peristaltic valves mimic the transport of a compound through the artificial gastrointestinal system. So you can literally feed TIM bacon and eggs and blueberries and watch what happens as it goes down. So that's a schematic of the whole thing. We did some work with wild berries, wild blueberries, and also some Amazonian maki berries. With TIM, we saw differences in using this model, differences in absorption of different kinds of anthocyanins. We think about anthocyanins as the pigment in berries and how available is it. But there's a lot of difference between different kinds of anthocyanins, and we found that here. We found that malvidin-containing anthocyanins had 17% bioaccessibility, which is a precursor to bioavailability, and delphinidin only 6.5%, so it was really low. And we're able to see that in using that model as well as some artificially obese rats. taking it through that same system. So interestingly, the bioaccessibility ranged and didn't correlate with the amount of anthocyanins that were in the extract. No, it's they did their own thing once they were in the in once they were ingested. So another thing we looked at using the same TIM system is we looked at blueberries, wild blueberries, and we looked at their bioaccessibility as a blueberry juice, or what happens if we take that blueberry juice and complex it with edible protein and feed it that way, same amount. And we found that when the blueberry was just fed as a juice, it's pretty quickly metabolized, and the structure of the anthocyanins was lost pretty quickly. But when it was complex with protein, it protected the blueberries and got down, more of it got down to the colon and was bioavailable down there and available to be metabolized by colonic microflora. So that's really important because a lot of these bioactive compounds are only from plants, from fruits and vegetables. A lot of them are really only bioavailable. Our understanding has completely turned upside down, right? We used to try and feed people fruits and vegetables and say, okay, how quickly are they getting the carotenoids? How quickly are they getting the anthocyanins? Let's take a blood draw and see. Doesn't work that way. We're finding out that so much of what we eat in fruits and vegetables has to be worked on by colonic microbiota and then be released into the system lag time. There's a great lag time there compared to what we used to do. We're not going to see it in a blood draw down here. We're going to see it later. We'll see the metabolites later. So one thing we're doing now, because we're working quite a bit in human systems now, is working on models that will let us see these results quickly, more quickly. When you eat a typical fruit or vegetable, it's got strawberry here, it may be a very long time with repeated ingestion, with chronic ingestion, before you start to see improvements. It's not that they aren't real improvements. They absolutely are, but that's how plants work. That's how food works, is you get improvements with habitual use of a food over a long period of time, and then you get improvements in your body. It's not like a drug. And the problem is, what? The problem is, you all know, the problem is that our funding agencies are not going to fund us for 10 years to look at, none of them are going to do that. So we're trying to look at how can we kind of make the results visible, make them understandable in a shorter period of time. And one thing we're working on now is we're looking at using an exercise model to make a more rapid delivery of colonically digested metabolites. And what we found, we have some publications on this, is that when we ingested blueberries, for example, when you had an athletic model where the athlete was working out, it opens up the colon and allows distribution of colonically digested anthocyanins back into the circulation more rapidly, much more rapidly than a person who's just sitting there like a couch potato. So, part of the reason that an athlete is getting more from their food, because they're really getting more absorption. And so we've got clinical studies running now where we're looking at ingestion of, I got blueberry there as an example, and then having people either walk or run. You know, do they have to really run hard to get the blueberries back into circulation, or just vigorous walking do it? And what happens when they just sit? And looking at, with blood draws, fecal collection, and urine collections, where those metabolites go, what happens to them, how it all works out. And what we're finding is that we get we find the attenuation of risk, we find a more significant increase in that attenuation of risk when we're using that exercise model, because it does kind of accelerate the uptake of these active compounds into the blood. Okay, so just to kind of wrap it up, back to the ohelo. The ohelo really got us going on this. The Hawaiian plant was the one that really got us into the mode of looking in all these different models, how bioaccessible these compounds could be. It allowed us to do this metabolic tracking in animal models using in vitro generated plants, using in vitro generated secondary metabolites. It allowed us to work with the metabolite tracking in the TNO gastrointestinal model. And so we worked with Ohelo and the label for a while, but we've done also just whole berries and fruit as well. And then now it's getting us into this metabolic tracking and looking at all the metabolites from berry ingestion and doing metabolic fingerprinting in human systems. So that's all I have for you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.